Let's continue now on this afternoon with a study which we shall call the Law of Love. Now this morning we were looking into 2 Corinthians chapter and saw there the difference between the ministration of death and the ministration of the spirits. Today we wish to go on now with the study of the law of God in greater detail. And we'll turn first of all to 1 John, the Epistle of John, the first Epistle of John. I don't know how or what the story is on that. 1 John 4 and verse 16. And we have known and believe the love that God hath to us. God is love. And he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God and God in him. Now in this particular verse we have the simple, plain statement that God is love. It just doesn't simply say God is loving, but God is love. Now if God is love, then love is what? God. They are one and the same thing. We come back now to Romans. He can copy it later from one of the other tapes if need be. Romans chapter 13, and let's look to verse 9. Romans 13, verse 9. For this thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet, and if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbour, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Now the question arises then, if God is love, and love is the fulfilling of the law, then this must indeed be the great law of love. Well, what does the word love mean? If we go today to the average person then and ask them what do they understand by the word love, I suppose you'd get a variety of responses. We have the modern love cults of the teenage world, and they have their idea of what love means. But I think we'll find, if we look at this word love and understand its true meaning, that you can't separate that word from this word, respect. Respect and reverence. Those two things go very much hand in hand. Let's go back a moment now to the Garden of Eden, when God first made man in that garden, and we shall seek to understand how it is that the obedience to God and to his law must in itself bring security and joy and trust and peace to mankind, whereas disobedience just as inevitably must bring suffering and loss and pain and so forth. Now in the Garden of Eden, God made this very beautiful home and gave it to our first parents. And I don't suppose that we have much of a concept of how great and magnificent that gift was to Adam and Eve. I think I gave the illustration a few days ago, and I'll do it again for those who are not here. Let's suppose that some man of means, of unlimited means, selected a very fine tract of land somewhere upon the face of this earth, a very large tract of land too, in a place where the climate was perfect, as modern climate can be. The valley was very beautifully watered, the scenery was marvellous, the soil was deep and rich and fertile. And he fenced this plot of ground, erected fine buildings, planted orchards, set out crops, bought the best of farm machinery, and after spending a great deal of time and money, had a magnificent farm going in the most perfect condition and highly productive state. And all the while, you were not even in the picture. You didn't know about it, you weren't helping in the project, you were making no contribution to it whatsoever. And then this man came to you and said, now look, I want you to come and take over this farm as a gift from me. No money, no price, nothing. Here are the title deeds, the whole thing is already made out in your name. Now, that happened to you, you'd rather think that you'd been the subject of a tremendous piece of generosity, wouldn't you? Think about it. A farm which in modern terms might be worth $100,000 or more. Now, that farmer would not have to do that at all. It would be, if he did it, an act of straight-out generosity, a gift of unparalleled proportions to you, who was a complete and perfect stranger to him. And I don't suppose that we'd find today upon the face of the earth any man who'd do that for me. And I suppose that you'd be hard put to find someone who'd do it for you. True? Now, supposing that this man was to say to you, there's just one tree down here in the orchard, I'll show you which one it is, that I'd like to reserve for myself for certain sentimental reasons or otherwise, and while all the rest of this magnificent farm is yours, I'd like you just to regard that one tree as being my own. Now, would you regard that man as being selfish? Well, hardly. How could you? Would you think he was unjust? Why, certainly not. Would you feel inclined to feel envious of his possession of that one tree, and would you like to go down and take it back for yourself? You wouldn't even think of those things, would you? This gives us perhaps a little bit of the idea of what God did for Adam and Eve back there in the Garden of Eden. Just a little bit. And I say a little bit because how could we measure the value of that farm and that garden which God gave to them back at that time? Why, the grandest farms or gardens or parts of the earth that we might today see could never begin to compare with the gift that God gave to Adam and Eve back there. And let's make this point very, very clear and plain in our minds. God did not, in any sense of the word, have to give to Adam and Eve that home, this world, and that garden. He could have made the whole thing and kept it entirely for himself, couldn't he? For instance, there is in this world a very wealthy man. I've just forgotten his name now, but I did read the story a few months ago in a newspaper. And this man has an unbelievably high income, hundreds of thousands of dollars, it seems, every week. And he couldn't possibly tell you how much he's worth. He has extensive investments in oil wells and so forth around the world. He continually is buying and selling, and the result is that his wealth is just simply beyond computation. Certainly he has no hope in the world of spending it all or using it all. He just simply piles it up and piles it up into a grand empire of financial proportions. Now, this man owns a number of estates around the world. I know there's one on an island in the Mediterranean Sea, another one in Italy, and the one where he mostly lives appears to be in the south of England. Now, if you're in England in the fall, you know what it means to look out and see the golden daffodils that spread themselves like a carpet in the meadows and in the fields. And his estate is no exception. Out there underneath the trees, in the green grass, every fall there springs up and blooms these tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of daffodils. They just simply grow wild. And one day, a woman who knew this man personally and could address him by his first name called up and said to him that she would like to have some daffodils, about 200 or 300, for a function for some disabled servicemen. And she asked, could she have some? The answer was a curt no. But she said, you'd never miss them. His answer was a cold, brief, I don't give. Certainly that man had no time to go out and enjoy those daffodils himself. I don't suppose he was hardly conscious of their existence. But that great garden of flowers was his, and in his mind he had no intention of giving so much as one to anybody else. And that's the kind of God that we could have served, isn't it? But God isn't that kind of person. God is the great giver, and to Adam and Eve, our first parents, he literally handed over that unspeakably extensive and glorious gift, this world, which God could have kept for himself in all its beauty, its fragrance, and its perfection, as a place where he could have come down and enjoyed himself, or even just simply had it there as an extravagant, superfluous thing that existed in his universe. But he chose to give the whole thing over to Adam and Eve. But now God understood that our first parents needed to be educated so far as the principles which guarantee their happiness is concerned. We're going to see as we go along that we need two things. When God writes his law in our hearts, as we saw this morning, that law written in our hearts, number one, is a disposition or a nature. And that disposition is the disposition to respect that which belongs to God and to our fellow men. But along with that, there also must be written an education. And the education goes along with this disposition, to strengthen the disposition, to give it reason and sense, and also to lay out before our minds what we are to respect. And you know, you'll find that many Christians, even though they have that disposition in their hearts, because they lack adequate Christian education, they mar the work of their hearts by not knowing quite what to do and how to do it at the appropriate time. Now, while God gives to us an instant disposition in the sense of the new birth, we do not get an instant education. That is the work of a lifetime. Now, all God asked of Adam and Eve was that they respect that which was his in the Garden of Eden. That one tree which he set aside his own property, God didn't especially need it for himself, but he set it aside as an educational means of bringing home to them the importance of showing the highest possible respect and regard for that which was the property of another's. Not to imagine for one moment that that tree possessed in it anything of a magical nature. It was no different from any other tree in the garden so far as its growth and fruit was concerned, but it was God's property. If you think about it, what makes a thing wrong is not the fact that you take a piece of fruit and eat it, but it's whose fruit and where and how and when you do that. Let's now study for a few moments and see how that when Adam and Eve lost their respect for that which belonged to God, that they broke every one of God's Ten Commandments. God had said in verse 17 of chapter 2, "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." Now Satan, of course, up in heaven, had lost a disposition to respect that which was God's or another's, and he was just as determined to come down to this earth and break the respect of Adam and Eve for the property of another. So come to chapter 3 and verse 1, let's begin to follow it through. "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, You shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, You shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." Now Satan at once said to her, in verse 4, "You shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God, knowing good and evil." Now, Lucifer, or Satan as he now was, came down and placed an altogether different construction on God's motive to that which was the real truth. He represented God, as we saw the other night, he'd done in his own mind, as one who was afraid that Adam and Eve might come up into a higher plane and share with God his position and his knowledge. And Satan said, "True, God has made a law, and that law forbids you to touch that tree. And God has said that he's made that restriction to save you from death. But, said Lucifer, this is not true. The truth of the matter is that God's law has been designed to limit you within a certain narrow sphere, and that limitation is a protection from God, preventing you from becoming a rival to him in his sphere. He wants to guarantee that you remain down there while he remains isolated in his position of superiority up here. That is the real purpose of this law. Now, at that time, Eve had not come to the place where her education provided a security for the outworking of the disposition to respect that which belonged to another and that which belonged to God. And of course, as we've seen, that the seal of God is both intellectually, it is both intellectual, I should say, intellectual and spiritual. Remember? Both. And of course, the true sealing of the people of God is their recognition of God's law. And so it was that when Satan was able to give to her mind a new education, by that new education, that wrong education, that wrong thinking, he was able to take away from her that disposition to respect that which was another's. Now, the position which Eve should have occupied was this, and this is a position which I think that everybody should fix in their minds. The position should have been that irrespective of what that fruit may do for me, it may, as Lucifer says, exalt me into the highest pinnacles of greatness and glory, yet the fact remains that that tree does not belong to me, and therefore no matter how much I may acquire by taking the property of another, I have absolutely no right to take it, and I will not take it, even though it may cost me my life. Now, how totally opposite that would have been to the disposition which we find in the world at the present time. Because today in the world, what is the attitude of people? I want it, and because I want it, I shall have it. No matter what means I need to stoop to in order to get that thing. Isn't that true? That's the modern disposition. What spirit animates the man who wants something, and when he can't get it, he kidnaps an innocent man, holds him up to ransom, and, as I've just done up there in Canada, and when his society doesn't give to him his demands, which are lawless demands and violent demands, then in cold blood they shoot the man, leave his body in a parking lot, in a car. What kind of disposition is that? Is that the kind of disposition which is going to build a secure world, a world free of fear, a world in which there's happiness and trust and confidence? Of course it's not. In the very nature of the case, that kind of disposition is going to rob the world of a sense of security, rob the world of peace, rob the world of trust, rob the world of all that can possibly make it to be a happy world, and introduce instead a different world altogether. Now, let us remember this principle, that no matter what advantages may appear to be ours by taking a certain step, if that step involves our laying hold upon the property of another person, if it involves therefore disrespect for that which belongs to another, then no matter what the cost may be, we cannot and we must not lay our hands upon that thing, irrespective of what the advantages may appear to be. Now, if that disposition had been firmly fixed in the heart of Eve back there, then what a different story the history of this world would have been. A vastly different story. But she believed Satan's lie. And when you believe a lie, what do you become a bearer of? False witness, don't you? Satan bore to Eve back there on that occasion a false witness of God. An untrue story. A picture of God which was wholly and totally untrue. And so therefore she broke the command, thou shalt not bear false witness. Did she not? That was the first one, because she believed Satan's lie and became a partaker of it, and then she came to act upon it. Now when she believed Satan's lie, look at verse 6 and see what took place next. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. Now when you read those words, and when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, what was she doing? Coveting. Good, so she broke that commandment, thou shalt not covet. And what did she do next? She took of the fruit, which is what? Stealing. So she stole. Now in the moment that she did that, she brought death. She and her husband brought death upon mankind. And if you stop to think about it, Adam and Eve are directly responsible for the death of every person who has ever died upon the face of this earth. That's something, isn't it? In other words, they are the greatest murderers of all time, apart from Satan himself. Because how did death come upon mankind? As by one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, as it says over there in the book of Romans. So they broke the command, thou shalt not kill. The next one in line. There it goes, thou shalt not kill. Let's move on down the line now. You may say to me, well, what about adultery? Did they commit adultery? Let's turn to the book of Jeremiah, shall we? We have to think of adultery merely as being a physical relationship between two human beings, but God doesn't limit it to that by any means. There's much more that's comprehended in the sin, thou shalt not commit adultery, than the experience of two human beings between each other upon the earth. Jeremiah 3, we come down to verse 8. And I saw, when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away, and given her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. And it came to pass, through the lightness of her whoredom, that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and with stocks. Now let me ask you this question. Was God condemning Israel here because of a physical relationship, or was this a condemnation of spiritual apostasy? Spiritual apostasy. And in direct terms, what did God call it? Adultery. Now, was God speaking symbolically? Was God speaking actually? He was speaking actually. Both Israel and Judah were directly guilty of adultery when they turned their backs on God and went off and found another husband, even the enemy of truth. Very good. Now, if God called that adultery, then what must God have called the departure or the flirtation, first of all, of Eve with Satan, and then Adam and Eve, the both of them, leaving off their relationship to God and going after the enemy of truth? What must God have called that? Adultery. If God called it that in one place, it must have been the same in the other place. So they definitely did, in the terms of God's language, commit adultery. Now come to the last of the commandments on the second side of the Decalogue, which says, honor thy father and thy mother, and so on. Did they honor their father, who is God, of course? Did they? No, say that they dishonored God. We turn now to the first four of the commandments on the first side of the Decalogue. That list is at number 7 for the moment. Because this list is not consecutive, of course, it's just, we just listen to them as we go through. And the first one says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Well, that's pretty simple, isn't it? Because very obviously they did have another god before the real God, and that god, of course, was the prince of this world, Satan. The second commandment reads, Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything in the heavens above or in the earth beneath. Well, now you may say to me, they didn't sit down and with a knife or a chisel begin to carve out a graven image. And therefore, how could we possibly say that they broke that particular commandment? There. But once again, the law of God is somewhat broader than we are apt to think. I'd like to read you now a statement here from the experience of Elijah, as it is outlined for us in the book Prophets and Kings. A moment, I'll just find this now. The page is page 177. Through the long centuries that have passed since Elijah's time, the record of his life work has brought inspiration and courage to those who have been called to stand for the right in the midst of apostasy. And for us, upon whom the ends of the world are come, it has special significance. History is being repeated. The world today has its Ahabs and its Jezebels. The present age is one of idolatry, as verily as was that in which Elijah lived. No outward shrine may be visible. There may be no image for the eye to rest upon. Yet thousands are following after the gods of this world, after riches, fame, pleasure, and the pleasing fables that permit man to follow the inclination of the unregenerate heart. And note the words very carefully. The present age is one of idolatry, as verily as was that in which Elijah lived. Now, which commandment in particular condemns idolatry? The second one, doesn't it? Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything which is in the heavens above or in the earth beneath or the waters under the earth. And here we find that this age is particularly one of idolatry, as surely as it was back there in Elijah's day. But then she continues, no outward shrine may be visible. There may be no image for the eye to rest upon. Yet thousands are following after the gods of this world, after riches, fame, pleasure, and the pleasing fables that permit man to follow the inclinations of the unregenerate heart. So do you actually have to have a graven image in order to break the second commandment, according to this statement? You don't, do you? That apple, well, I shouldn't call it an apple because the Bible doesn't say particularly what kind of fruit it was. It may have been an apple, a peach, a plum. It may have been a fruit that doesn't even exist today in the world. But that piece of fruit became the visible symbol or object of worship so far as they were concerned. It symbolized all that they were seeking to gain. The same as we saw this morning, the golden calf was a symbol of something which in their minds they were worshipping. And I think if we can understand it, you must agree that they did break the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Now come to the next one, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Now, the word vain, we say, I went in search of my friend, but my quest was in vain. We mean by that the quest was fruitless or pointless or unsuccessful. Now, to take God's name is to call yourself a Christian, is to call yourself a child of God, is to claim sonship with God. Now, if you do not live the life of a Christian and you take his name, then how do you take that name? In vain. Now, Adam and Eve called themselves the sons of God. They had taken that name. But once they sinned and turned away from God, how then did they take that name? In vain. So they took his name in vain. You just put here the words in vain. Now this brings us down to the last of the Ten Commandments, the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. And so on. Now in our previous study together, we've seen that the Sabbath of God is the symbol of the power of God. So that where the power of God is, the Sabbath of God is. And if you take away the power of God, what do you take away? The Sabbath of God. Isn't that clear? Now in just a few moments too, we'll see also that you cannot separate the test which Adam and Eve faced in the Garden of Eden from the Sabbath test which the world faces at the present time. And to break the one in principle, or in fact I should say, is to break the other one in principle, because they stand upon the same ground. Now as surely as Adam and Eve broke off their connection with God, they lost whose power? The power of God. God's power left them and was taken away from them. And as surely as God's power went out, what had to go with it? The Sabbath of God. So, in sure and plain terms, they broke the Sabbath of God and lost it out of their lives when they turned their backs upon Him. Now, the law is the law of love. And love is respect. And when Eve lost her respect for that which belonged to God, then in actual fact she broke in specific terms every single one of those Ten Commandments, didn't she? None missing. And I ask you this simple question, what else could she have broken beyond that? That's all, isn't it? That's comprehensive. Everything is included, nothing is omitted, and she broke every one of those Ten Commandments. And of course, Adam in turn with her. Now, let's spend a few moments trying, if we can, to understand how it is that when that law of respect is broken, then straight away we have a position in this world where unhappiness and suspicion and mistrust and quarreling and strife and death can be the only possible outcome of the situation. Very good. Now let's think first of all of how things would be if every living being, first of all, had deeply rooted in their hearts this disposition, an inviolable disposition to love and respect that which belongs to another person. And at the same time, they understood in their minds just what did belong to the other person. And lastly, they understood in their minds the fearful consequences of breaking that law of respect. Very good. It would mean, if this was so, that I could have a beautiful home, shall we say, and in that home, in just plain cash, I could have $1 million. I'm going to really paint the story now in very strong terms. And every person in the land in which I lived knew perfectly well where that home was and where that money was in that house. It would mean that I could go away from that home and leave no guards and no dogs and no bolts and no bars and no locks in that house. I would go away to the farthest end of the world and have in my mind the most perfect rest and trust and knowledge that when I came back again, every penny of that money would still be there, couldn't I? Now, what would I have in my heart? I'd have confidence, I'd have trust, I'd have peace, I'd have rest, and my attitude toward my fellow men would be one of kindness and benevolence and love and respect for them. Now, wouldn't that be a wonderful world to live in? Why, certainly. And that was the very thing that God sought to teach Adam and Eve back there in the Garden of Eden. That's why God said to them, here is that tree, it belongs to me, and I want you to respect it. All the rest is yours, but this is mine. And God desired them to see also if they could not and would not respect it, then in that very act they would at once introduce into this world a system of things which would break up that trust and that confidence and that love and that peace and so on, which is so needful for the upbuilding of mankind. Now, what person today in all of this land would dare to leave an unlocked house in the middle of which was a few $100s, let alone $1 million, and go away without guards and bolts and bars and so forth to a far country and expect to come back and find it still there if all the world knew about it? Just nobody. Just nobody. The facts are that he leaves his house locked and barred, and he has a protection system from these firms which protect homes, and he goes away and he can't help but be anxious on the whole trip for fear he'll come back and find his house broken into or burned down, his money gone, his property lost as far as he is concerned. That's the way things are. Now, let's understand now that this reduces a lawbreaker, and I don't care what particular thing a person does, that you can break the whole thing down and call a person a common thief. That all sin can be summed up in that word, stealing. Well, let's look at it for a moment. Take the adulterer. What is he doing? He's stealing another man's property, isn't he? He's a thief. Very good. Take the man who, shall we say, well, coveting, of course, is so close to the allies of stealing, it's the same thing. But take a man who bears false witness. That man is stealing another man's reputation, isn't he? And therefore stealing away part of his life. Take the man who dishonors his father, then that person is stealing the honor which a father must expect from a son. He's a common thief. Come down to the man who takes God's name in vain, and that person is doing the same thing. He's stealing his father's reputation and the service which all of us owe back and turn to God. And now come to the Sabbath commandment, and let's see how that a person who breaks it is nothing more nor less than a common petty thief. And here it is. Now, back in the Garden of Eden, God gave to man the whole world and the garden which was in that world. And God also gave to them, as he gives to us today, time. There it is. Now, you just ask yourself the question, where do you get your time from? Is there a great time machine that you can go along to and crank time out? Of course you can't. This time that's given to us is a gift from God. And even the protection which ensures we have the use of that time comes to us from God. And so God says to us, at no cost to ourselves whatsoever, because you can't buy time, God says, very good, this is yours. It's my gift to you. But, the Lord says, of all that time, 1/7 part of that time belongs to me. There it is, 1/7. And not just any seventh, but the seventh day of every week belongs to God. When that sun goes down behind the western hills on Friday evening, until exactly 24 hours later, we have a portion of time which God has reserved to himself. Very good. Now, can you or any man justly charge God with selfishness when he claims that time for his own? Why, of course you can't. Because we agreed earlier in the study that if a man gave to you a great and extensive farm, all beautifully set up and prepared and so forth, if that man retained one part of that farm for himself, even half it for himself, or 2/3 of it for himself, we couldn't charge that man with being selfish. Because he didn't have to give any of it to you at all. And likewise, God doesn't have to give you any time. He doesn't have to give you existence, but he has. And therefore all of our time belongs to him, but he only calls in particular terms for 1/7 of that time for himself. Now then, what difference is there, or is there any difference between the act of Adam and Eve and taking of that fruit which belonged to another in the Garden of Eden and the act of any man who appropriates any part of that day for his own interest, his own work, or his own pleasure? What's the difference? There's no difference, is there? None whatsoever. I believe that today we can go to those in the world who deny the Sabbath truth and plainly show them the nature of what they're doing. They are demonstrating that they have no respect at all for God and for his truth, and in turn they thereby designate themselves to be nothing more or less than common thieves. That's how it is. The same is true with the tithe question, because the Sister White says the tithe and the Sabbath belong on the same level exactly. You can take these three things in particular, the tree in the Garden of Eden, God's holy time, and the tithe, which is God's means, of course. Now, the wealth that you have, and the strength that God gives you to gather that wealth, because remember this, we don't manufacture wealth. With the strength that we have, we gather the wealth that's in this world to be gathered. We don't manufacture wealth or invent it. It's all there in the soil and in the sea. Because if you think about it, every single thing that you have, look around this room, the clothing you have in your bodies, the food you eat, it all comes from the earth and from the sea and nowhere else. Isn't that true? Nowhere else. And who put it there? God did. And with the strength that God gives to us, we gather that wealth that God has laid there to be accumulated by human hands for the support of our lives. Now God says to us, it's all yours, every bit of it. But he said, one tenth of that is to be reserved for myself because I have not given you the tenth, that belongs to me. Now you know we say we pay tithe. I wonder if we really are saying the right thing when we say we pay tithe. Because how can you pay something that never was yours to pay anyway? How can you? More explicitly, we should say, well, that's God's money. It's come into my hands as a trust, and so I return it back to the great giver. Now, of course, God is so great a giver that when you turn that tenth back to him, what does he do with it? Well, he simply pays it back to you in the service of his ministry. He uses that money as a means of bringing back to you blessings that you otherwise could never have. That's why in Malachi 3 it says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be what? Meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord, if I'll not open you the windows of heaven, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. God is so great a giver that he just turns these things back to us again for our own blessing and for our own uplift. And what about the Sabbath? God returns that to us again, that time, and on that day, God pours out to us blessings which we would never have time to receive during the week that goes before. Therefore, as it says in Malachi, chapter 3 and verse 8, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me, but you say, wherein have we robbed thee? The answer, in tithes and offerings. You're cursed with a curse, for you rob me, even this whole nation. You know, it's a bad thing for a man to rob a fellow man. But for a man to rob God is something which is infinitely worse than to rob a fellow man. Now, you know, we have today in the world men who say they love God and respect him and serve him, and yet they don't observe the seventh day, which is God's time. They don't pay God that faithful, now I use that term again, they don't return to God that faithful tenth which belongs to him and never does belong to the human race, even though they know perfectly well what the Word of God says in regard to these things. Now let's think about this for a moment. In human society, we fear a thief. Isn't that true? If you're living in a neighborhood and the word gets around there's a thief on the rampage, why, Mrs. Brown, did you hear about her? Her house has been broken into. And they stole all her best silver, and they took those paintings from the wall, and they found so much cash in the house, and they were gone while they were away on vacation. And a few more days passes, and someone says, and there's Mr. Jones's house is broken into last night, and it's plain it was the same thief because he left behind the same marks of his calling. Now, what happens at once? A chill of fear descends on that neighborhood, isn't that true? And at night time, folk go around and with greater care than normally, lock their doors. And all night long they sleep lightly with their ears listening for the invader. And when that thief is caught, that society demands that that man be locked away from this society. Put in prison, where he has no power at all to continue his depredations. And after a period of time, when they think the man has been sufficiently punished, they let him go. But if he repeats the crime, what do they do again? Again, they lock him up in prison. And of course, if he goes so far as to steal a man's life, then he may be put away in prison for the rest of his life, or in turn, he may be so completely put away from society as to be killed in the electric chair or the gas chamber, as the case may be. Now, men have limited power to catch a thief. They can't always securely recognize or prove that this particular man did the stealing, and sometimes, therefore, thieves for years and maybe for a lifetime escape justice in this world. But let's mark this point with the greatest of care. Nobody, just nobody, can deceive God. God knows those who faithfully respect that which is His, and God knows that you and I and the angels are not going to be happy in heaven if a bunch of thieves are up there, are we? We're not going to want that kind of heaven. Would you want to be in heaven where in that kingdom there are thieves going around and stealing that which belongs to another person? Well, of course we wouldn't. And therefore, you and I and every other person expects that heaven will be a place completely free from those kind of characters. Now this cuts both ways. Because if we expect that all other thieves are kept out of heaven, what about me if I'm a thief? The same thing. Fair enough. And therefore, anybody who does not respect God's sacred seventh, the seventh day, and therefore is nothing but a common thief, and all those who do not respect God's money, His tenth, certainly are self-deceived if they think they have any hope in the wide world of entering into God's kingdom. It can't be, because God knows that the law of respect is one which we must learn if we're going to have any hope of establishing a society in which there is trust, confidence, security, blessing, and the like. Now this means then that in simple terms, God's law is love. There it is. That is the law of God. The Ten Commandments define what is to be respected. See the difference? Go through them one by one. It talks about man's property. Take the one of adultery. That is to respect another man's wife. Thou shalt not kill. That covers a man's life. Stealing property in general. Coveting, of course, covers a desire, and it goes right back to the root of the whole problem. False witness is a man's reputation, and so on, all down through here, God's place and station, and so forth. If you analyze the Ten Commandments, you'll find that the Ten Commandments defines those things which we are to respect. Whereas the law of God is in itself the great principle of respect. As we say, it's twofold. One, it is a disposition, and two, of course, it is the education. Now, I want you for a moment to consider God Himself and ask yourself this question: is God requiring of us something which He Himself does not do? And the answer is definitely not. Take, for instance, this point. Now, God has given to you individuality. He's given to you the power of choice. And therefore, God absolutely respects that which He has given to you as your property and does not come in and reclaim that which is yours just because you're mishandling that property. Now you think back on your own past experience. Today, every person in this room is here because of their own choice. How many of you were forced to come here today by someone putting a gun in your ribs and saying you're going to that meeting whether you like it or not? How many of you? Not one. And if at this moment any one of you was to decide that you had heard enough, you didn't like the principles being spoken in these meetings, and you chose to leave this place and go out and lead a life of utter abandonment to sin and to waywardness, would God stop you? Why not? Because God respects your right to make your own choice, doesn't He? Now, if God so completely respects our wishes and our desires, even though those desires will take us right down to destruction and death, then should not we in turn learn to respect Him and each other? Now, ask yourself the question, honestly and fairly, how else would you have it? Would you like to be placed in a position where you are forced to serve God? Where you had to come to meetings? Where you had to return that tithe to Him? Where you had to observe the seventh day? where you had to refrain from doing things that you wanted to do in your heart? Would you like to be in that situation? Well, of course you wouldn't. You're glad, aren't you, that we have a God who absolutely lets you do what you want to do, even though the doing of it is going to bring to you sorrow and trouble and distress and ultimately death. The papacy, of course, is a system where force and compulsion is the way of doing things. Remember how back in the early days when the Roman Catholic priesthood lost their control, or rather I should say, their power to appeal to the people, they so lost the connection with God they had nothing to offer to the people, and so the people just quit coming to church. And on Sundays they'd far rather go out and plow the fields and plant their grain and so forth than they would to come to church. Well, the priest said this will never do, and they went to the state and they had the government pass a law which said the people had to come to church whether they whether they had to quit working on Sunday whether they liked it or not. And so they stopped working. But this didn't bring them to church. They now went to play in the theatre and the playing field on Sunday. So the priest had a second law passed which forbade work on Sunday and play on Sunday. And now the people sat at home and enjoyed themselves all day, resting underneath their favourite shade tree. Well, when the priesthood found that neither of these laws was sufficient, then they made a third law which said they could not work, they could not play, they could not stay at home, but they had to come to church on Sunday. And the people came to sit in utter boredom and discomfort through the long, tedious hours of religious service, to have money drained out of them by the pressures and appeals of the priests, and to go home disgruntled and unhappy from a very ill-spent day in those cold, bleak churches from which there was preached only cold, bleak sermons. Is that the kind of God we serve? Well, of course it's not. Absolutely not. Now, as Christians, we have to learn to respect each other. Now, well, it may well be that you see one of your dearest brethren or sisters in this movement making choices which in your eyes are going to lead to trouble and to disaster. Very well, let them. That's their business, not ours. Of course, if in God's own great and wonderful way, He brings and creates the opportunity where you can talk over this matter together, and you have the chance of giving counsel to that person, as they invite that counsel, then of course do so. But as you do so, carefully watch the situation to recognize when you have gone to the limit of your rights in the matter. When that other person begins to close up and doesn't want to talk about it, then respect the other person's wishes and do not for one moment continue to press your case upon that person. You know, it's a hallmark of false religion that they will pressurize you to believe what they want you to believe. And I found in my own heart and life that the disposition which I have found growing since this message came is, if a person doesn't want this message, then I have no disposition to go after them and force it upon them. In fact, rather, perhaps sometimes I almost feel as if we might be a little bit too hesitant to go to folk. But in this way, of course, those who really want the message come and get it, and those who don't drift along in their own fashion and go their own way. Now, when a person makes a decision which is going to bring them trouble, pray for them. But don't chase them. Don't annoy them. Don't judge them as, in your view, having done the wrong thing. Their decision is made. Let them go their way because that's their choice, and it's our business to respect the choice the other person makes entirely and completely. And this is a law that we absolutely have to learn if we're going to see happiness and peace and trust come in amongst God's people. Now, I believe that when we can understand and see the law of God as the great law of love, which is intelligent, enlightened respect for other people and for God, not just an emotion, not just a happy feeling, not just a sense of loyalty, but something which is a thorough education in these principles, then we shall understand just what God's law is in truth and in fact, and be able to live upon this earth a life which will be pleasing to our fellow men, which will be pleasing to God, and which will eliminate from our society those troubles and difficulties which are the overthrowing and the undoing of the world at the present time. And I trust that God will teach us to understand His law and to follow it all the way. Now, I believe David understood these principles. Let's go back to Psalms 19 just very briefly in concluding this afternoon. And in verse 7, David said, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is thy servant warned, and in keeping of them there is great reward." Very good. Now, the law of God is only going to be more desirable to you than gold if you understand it as being the recipe, if I can use that word, or the formula whereby security and happiness and peace and health and eternal life are guaranteed to you and to all other members of your society. But if Satan's lie is to be believed by us, in which he represents the law as being a restriction which cuts you off from that which you ought to have, if the representation of it as being a bondage or a yoke, something which robs you of what you ought to have, then of course, how could you say with David, it's more to be desired than fine gold, yea, than much sweeter also than the honeycomb? We couldn't. So we have to come to understand and see how it is by its very nature and construction. The law of God is perfect and it is designed and will infallibly result in joy and happiness and peace and security for all those who understand its principles and live out those principles in their daily life. Now, I trust that God will give us this understanding so that we shall be able to enjoy the fruits of obedience to God's sacred law.